Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case for argument this morning is Premium Plus Partners against Goldman Sachs. Mr. Fonta.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Anthony Feda, and I represent the plaintiffs' appellants. We respectfully request that the court vacate the class certification orders by the district court and remand this case, the premium case, with instructions to certify the single-day trading class proper to the court below. We also respectfully request that the court allow proposed intervener George Tomlinson to intervene in the premium litigation for purposes of representing the class. We ask that the court reject Goldman's argument that Premium does not have Article III standing to pursue this appeal. And we ask that the court remand the premium litigation with instructions to allow these two plaintiffs to represent the class. We also request that the court that this court reverse Judge Bucklow's dismissal of the Tomlinson plaintiff's complaint on statute of limitations grounds and remand that case with instructions to reinstate the claims and to stay them pending resolution of the premium class litigation. The district court's failure to certify the single-day trading class was an abuse of discretion predicated on errors of law and a failure to meaningfully examine significant developments in the case. Most notably, shortly before that motion was filed, this court entered a ruling in the case of Cohen versus Pacific Investment Management Company. Cohen involved the same legal theory and the same factual theory as the proposed class advanced by Premium Plus Partners. The proposed class before Judge Driagian consisted of short holders of 30-year Chicago Board of Trade, Treasury futures contracts, and call options contracts with a maturity date in December 2001. The class alleged that on a single trading day, Goldman acquired an illicit long position that caused artificial price increases in the instruments at issue, such that when class members covered their short positions during a finite 5-hour and 25-minute period, they did so at artificially inflated prices. Cohen, the decision by this court, also involved a claim involving the Chicago Board of Trade Treasury markets, a claim of manipulation, the same legal theory, violation of the anti-manipulation provisions of the Commodity Exchange Act, and the same factual theory, a long position acquired by the defendant that caused artificial inflation. Cohen affirmed certification of a 7-week class of shorts, investors who covered during a 7-week period. The class proposed by Premium in the Rule 23C1C motion was far narrower in time. It consisted of investors who covered short positions during a 5-hour and 25-minute period. The district court did not meaningfully consider Cohen. Instead, in a single sentence, it held that it had reviewed the case law cited by Premium and decided that the case law was distinguishable, but it never explained why that case law was distinguishable, and indeed it was not. It was directly relevant authority from this court that involved the same factual theory and the same legal theory and the same types of investors in the Chicago Board of Trade Treasury markets. The district court also failed to meaningfully consider its own factual findings in denying Goldman's motion for summary judgment. In particular, the district court held that there was sufficient evidence of artificiality caused by Goldman during the period 9:35 a.m. to 3 p.m. on October 31, 2001, to warrant a trial on the merits. This period, 9:35 a.m. to 3 p.m., was coextensive with the class that Premium set forth in its Rule 23C1C motion. In other words, the district court held that with respect to this time period, the claims merited a trial. Yet it did not reconsider class certification in light of that significant development. And that development was very significant in the context of the procedural history of this case, because in denying Premium's initial motion for class certification, the court predicted the merits of the case. It predicted that the claims of Premium and investors like Premium were speculative. Then, subsequently, after discovery was allowed, after expert reports on the merits were tendered to the court, it held that, contrary to its earlier prediction, the claims of Premium and similarly situated investors were not speculative, At that time, it was only related to Premium's claim, but Premium's claim and the evidence that it tendered to the court in support of its motion for summary judgment consisted of econometric analysis that was uniform, regardless of whether class members covered short positions in December 2001 futures or options. The import of that is this. When the district court held Premium presented sufficient evidence that warranted trial on the issue of artificiality and causation, it meant that the class, in effect, could present that same exact evidence at trial. Premium filed its Rule 23C1C motion on the heels of several key developments in the case. Developments genuinely warranting revisitation of the class certification issue. Rule 23 requires the courts to decide class certification early in the case. Oftentimes, as the Eighth Circuit recognized in Blades v. Monsanto, this is before complete merits discovery, such that when merits discovery is completed, the court may have to revisit its initial class determination.
Before you go too much into detail about the lengthy procedural history of the case, perhaps you could address the threshold issue of standing in light of the settlement here. Is there a question about the reimbursability of the 35% attorney's fees that was called for in light of the contingency agreement here, the contingency fee payment, if there is no class certification? Is it clear that the 35% can be recouped by the plaintiff?
Your Honor, yes. If a class is certified and prevails, plaintiff can shift and share those costs and fees with the class.
What in the fee agreement says that? It sets forth two different manners of compensation. One, if the class is certified, and another, if the class is not certified. The class was not certified here. Payment of damages was made and accepted, and the agreement calls for attorney's fees to be paid on a contingency fee basis, 35% of that recovery, which your opponents argue can't be recouped under the language of the agreement, and therefore there's no standing because there is no continuing interest in spreading costs of litigation.
Respectfully, the defendant's argument on that point is wrong. Under the contingency fee agreement, if a class is certified, if this court reverses and certifies a class, Premium's counsel has to petition the court for reimbursement of fees and expenses and cannot look to Premium for that amount. So if a class is certified,
counsel, what difference does that make given decisions such as Lewis against Continental Bank Corporation? Lewis holds that if the merits are moot, that an ongoing dispute about attorney's fees is not sufficient for an Article III case or controversy. And it looks like that's what you're arguing, that the merits might be moot because your clients have accepted a Rule 68 offer, but they want more attorney's fees, which they can get via the class, and it looks like that's just what Lewis said was insufficient.
Your Honor, in this case, we have a class case.
Not asking about this case. I'm asking about how your argument can be reconciled with Lewis.
Yes, Your Honor. We have dual interests in a class case. And I'm not familiar with the exact factual circumstances of Lewis.
I didn't say anything about the factual circumstances of Lewis. It's a decision by the Supreme Court of the United States. It has a holding. The holding is that an ongoing dispute about attorney's fees does not suffice for an Article III case or controversy when the underlying dispute on the merits has been settled. And that sure looks like this situation.
The remaining dispute in this case is not about attorney's fees. It's about class certification and Premium's interest.
The interest your clients assert in class certification is that if the class is certified, your clients may be able to spread the attorney's fees more widely. Your clients don't have any interest in the merits because they've settled.
Yes, Your Honor. And in Roper and in this court's decisions in Murrow and Wrightsell, the court...
Well, we can't contradict the Supreme Court.
Even if this court were to find that Premium lacks standing to pursue the appeal, There is a proposed intervener, George Tomlinson, who should have been.
I understand. Tomlinson could make such an argument. Tomlinson's problem is he's litigated and lost. So he's not even a member of the class.
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, because Tomlinson filed his complaint solely to preserve limitations claims. He sought to relate it into the premium
lost,
case.
But he's lost, right? Now, maybe if we reverse, Tomlinson has filed a separate appeal. I can understand the argument that if we reverse on that appeal, he gets his claim back and maybe he can intervene in this case and take over from your clients. The Supreme Court has held that even if an individual class case is moot, the original representative plaintiffs may be able to keep the case warm for intervention, right? I understand that theory. That's what Tomlinson wants out of this. But if Tomlinson's case, you know, if we either agree with the conclusion that Tomlinson loses on that ground or there's otherwise some problem with his intervention, we're back to your original plaintiff's premium plus claim that I want, you know, more contribution toward attorney's fees, right? That seems to go right up against Lewis. So maybe that drives us to Tomlinson. So perhaps you want to discuss Tomlinson, because it would have to go in sequence. First, we would have to reverse and say he's got a live claim rather than a dead one. And then we would have to say that he had to be allowed to intervene.
I will discuss Tomlinson. His motion was filed under Rule 24. And despite the fact that Judge Bucklow determined that his individual complaint was barred on limitations grounds, he has an interest in appealing the denial of class certification in the premium litigation because that will obtain an intervening decision which undoes the factual predicate for Judge Bucklow's decision. The limitations ruling by Judge Bucklow.
You can't go in that order. Tomlinson has already lost his claim. He doesn't have a claim against Goldman Sachs. He's litigated and lost. If Tomlinson wants to intervene here, the first step has to be we have to reverse Judge Bucklow. Then we can talk about intervention, but we can't say he should be allowed to intervene and then we'll worry about whether he has a claim that he's lost, because he's not, at the moment, he's not in the class.
The res judicata doctrine provides that if an intervening decision is obtained, res judicata does not apply. And that was set forth in the State Farm Supreme Court case cited in our brief, Your Honor. This would be, in effect, be an intervening decision because it would undo the factual predicate for Judge Bucklow's decision that tolling stopped on August 22, 2008.
I hope you will eventually take my invitation to address this in a sequence that might be helpful.
I will do so, Your Honor. The Tomlinson plaintiff's complaint should not have been dismissed on limitations ground. The district court misapplied the law regarding statute of limitations and ignored the key triggering event set forth in the complaint. The law in this court is clear that the statute of limitations does not begin to run until the plaintiff knows he has been injured and who injured him. In this case, there is no way for the Tomlinson plaintiffs to know that they were injured until September 3, 2003. That's when, for the first time, the Securities Exchange Commission announced charges against Goldman, and in doing so, outlined what Goldman had done on the day in question, namely that it acquired a long position in 30-year Chicago Board of Trade December contracts and the bonds deliverable against the contracts. Those facts were never in the public domain before September 3, 2003.
There was a great deal of information in the public domain, though, about the investigations that were underway and the course of conduct that the investigations were based on, and Judge Bucklow said that was sufficient to put you on inquiry notice. Why isn't that enough?
Your Honor, if you line up the facts in the public domain, you would not see anything resembling a manipulation claim. The investigations at issue related to insider trading by Goldman Sachs. Insider trading is very different from manipulation. For an insider trading claim, people who traded with Goldman may have known that it had inside information, and if it traded a few contracts or a few bonds, they may have a claim. The Tomlinson plaintiffs covered short positions much later in the day. Theirs is commodities manipulation claim. That required knowledge that Goldman acquired a sufficiently large long position in December contracts and deliverable bonds to have actually moved prices. Those facts were not revealed until September 3, 2003. The insider trading investigation does not relate to the plaintiffs because they don't have insider trading claims relating to securities. They have commodity manipulation claims. And the only reason the law requires that the statute of limitations doesn't run until the plaintiffs have a reasonable evidentiary basis to state their claim that they were injured and who caused the injury. The Tomlinson plaintiffs could not even begin to have a reasonable evidentiary basis until they knew that Goldman acquired a significantly large long position in December contracts and deliverable bonds to have actually moved prices and to have actually caused artificiality through the Treasury Department's announcement on the day in question. Goldman's limitation defense cannot be reconciled with its repeated claims in the case that the market's simply too large for them to have manipulated it. And the newspaper articles showed that there was an extraordinary trading day involving an extraordinary Treasury Department announcement, and that was the world folks were living in back in 2002 and 2003, the early part of 2003. There was no reference in any of those articles that Goldman acquired December contracts, the futures at issue here. There was no reference in any of those articles that Goldman acquired a sufficiently large position in bonds and December contracts to have actually moved prices, or that they retained those positions through the Treasury Department's announcement. It would have been pure speculation for the Tomlinson plaintiffs to have attempted to file suit before September 2003.
Wasn't there information in those articles about Goldman being one of Davis's clients, and that that Goldman received embargoed information prior to the release time, and that it was trading in those bonds prior to the release of the information?
Yes, Your Honor. That information
was. That's a lot for Tomlinson to go on.
Your Honor, that's a lot for an insider trading claim if Tomlinson had traded with Goldman or in the same time frame as Goldman. But the Tomlinson plaintiffs' trade covered their short positions after the Treasury Department announcement became public, after the insider window, if you will. And there was nothing for Tomlinson to go on in those articles, nothing for the Tomlinson plaintiffs to go on in those articles that would give them reason to believe that Goldman acquired enough contracts during the insider window and then retained them and to have caused artificial inflation later on in the day when they covered their short positions.
Well, what else would it have been doing?
It would have been simply trading on insider information, which is different than manipulation, Your Honor. An inside trader tries to acquire stock under value and then sell it when the prices rise based on the information that only it knows. A manipulator tries to acquire a sufficiently large long position, well-timed, to artificially inflate prices beyond where they should go. And that's what Goldman did here.
Are you contending that Goldman held a position exceeding the Board of Trade's position limits?
No, Your Honor, and this is a different type of manipulation case than one might normally see. What we have here is
It sounds like the type of manipulation case it is that every time somebody attempts to articulate what your position is, you say it's something else.
Well, Your Honor, as one court has said, the forms of manipulation are known only to the ingenuity of man. And in this case, Goldman acquired a long position on advanced information and timed it through.
This kind of claim is essentially that they had market power. Was this contract cash settled or delivery only?
It was settled through the cash, or contracts could be offset.
I think there's a very widely held belief that no cash settled contract can possibly be manipulated because no one has a monopoly position in the supply of cash.
And indeed, that was Judge Reagan's initial impression of the case. But in fighting Goldman's two motions for summary judgment, we were able to present sound econometric proof, evidence, that Goldman, in fact, did cause artificial inflation in the contract prices during the period 9:35 to 3 p.m., a 5-hour and 25-minute period. What Goldman did was, through high-volume order flow, timed shortly before an important public announcement, took supply away from the market, and withheld that supply from the market for a sufficient period of time after the announcement. And that caused the artificial inflation on the day in question. And the complaint returning to the allegations of the Tomlinson plaintiff's complaint, makes it clear that, or alleges that the Tomlinson plaintiffs could not have known that Goldman acquired the long position until September 3, 2003. The newspaper articles had to trump that, had to irrefutably trump that, and they simply didn't. If you review Judge Bucklow's opinion, the opinion acknowledges that trading volume was not referenced in the articles. It also references the fact that the newspaper article showed this was an extraordinary day.
Well, what she actually said is that the precise trading volume was unknown, but it was plainly known and much reported in the immediate aftermath and ensuing months that trading was significantly stepped up and had a possible impact on the market. That was well known and well reported.
Stepped up trading is something different than acquiring sufficiently large long position.
The point is that it's sufficient to put you on inquiry notice.
It is not, Your Honor, respectfully. What inquiry notice required under the discovery rule is that artificial inflation was caused when the Tomlinson plaintiffs covered their short position. And the only way they could have inquiry notice of that is that they knew Goldman acquired a sufficiently large long position to have caused that inflation. The stepped up its trading may be consistent with insider trading, but it does not provide a reasonable evidentiary basis for a manipulation claim, even with that news article. And that news article does not reference what markets are being talked about. But even assuming it was known that Goldman stepped up trading in December 2001 contracts, which were never mentioned in the article, that would not equate to manipulation. Traders step up trading and back off trading all the time. But that's different than what Goldman did here, which was through transactions representing approximately 52% of the futures market during the 8-minute window and 70% of the bond market during the 8-minute window, acquired a long position, which it later retained. Those percentages and nothing coming close to those percentages are referenced in any of the newspaper articles. Unless the court has further questions at this time, I'd like to sit down now, reserve my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Feta.
Thank you.
Ms. Coverly.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Every issue in this case turns on the strategic choices made by these plaintiffs and the law firm that represents them. They chose to pursue certification of a single class that included people who bought a whole array of instruments without proposing subclasses or alternatives. When they lost that, they chose to settle Premium Plus's individual claim. Meanwhile, Mr. Tomlinson, represented by the same firm, chose to take his chances before a different judge and didn't move to stay his individual lawsuit, actually pursued it. But at the same time, it was a poor choice because he waited too long to sue. So his claim was time-barred. And, of course, Premium Plus, in accepting the offer of judgment, left the prejudgment interest issue to the district court to resolve and didn't preserve its right to appeal. Those are all the issues the court needs to resolve. In fact, we submit the court doesn't need to resolve the class certification issue. But all of those issues ultimately turn on the strategic choices of these parties. I'd like to start, if I could, with the intervention issue, which I recognize is the second issue. The first issue the court will need to resolve is the standing issue, and that's been discussed already. That's an issue that this court resolves in the first instance, not resolved before in the case, and we submit, we have shown under this court's decision in Muro and other cases that there is no standing to pursue the appeal in Premium Plus's behalf. But as for intervention, an absent class member can intervene to pursue class certification, or he can file his own lawsuit. Those are the choices. He can't do both. And the key here is not only that he lost, although we do think that's very important. We think that Mr. Tomlinson is barred from intervention even if this court were to reverse the timeliness holding. And that's because he chose to pursue his claim, actually move forward with the litigation before a different judge. What he saw, you see, after class certification was denied, he had still some time left on the statute of limitations to file, but he didn't file. Instead, he waited 7 months long after the limitations period had expired, to file his own claim. At the same time, though, he saw that he had the ability to proceed before a different judge when the case was not reassigned to Judge Der Yagen, and yet he didn't seek a stay. He moved forward with the litigation, litigated on the merits, briefs were submitted. And having made that choice, having made the choice to pursue his individual suit before a different judge, he has opted out. He can no longer jump back into the class simply because he decided he made a bad choice in proceeding before Judge Bucklow alone. Beyond the intervention issue, let's talk about the timeliness question. Judge Bucklow didn't commit any error in concluding that Tomlinson waited too long. By no later than April 23, 2002, all the plaintiffs, had all the facts they needed to file their suit. They all had 2 years to file. And yet for a year and almost 11 months, no one filed anything. Premium Plus itself waited until there was only 1 month left on the limitations period before it filed the class action. And then, of course, we all agree that the limitations period was told during the pendency of the class action. But once class certification was denied, Tomlinson still had a month left, more than a month left, to file his lawsuit. He was represented by the same lawyers. He knew very well what was going on in the Premium Plus litigation and was on notice that his interests were no longer being protected by the pendency of the class action. And he had a month to file a suit, and he didn't do it. He waited 7 months, long after the period was over. And we know when the period began to run because of the many articles that both parties submitted to the district court. Judge Bucklow took judicial notice of media reports on both sides showing what information was available when. The plaintiffs object now that that was inappropriate for a motion to dismiss, but they didn't object below. In fact, they invited that inquiry by including many of the same articles in their complaint, and Judge Bucklow specifically noted in her decision that there was no objection to her looking to those articles and taking judicial notice of what they contained. And I invite the court to look at the articles and to look at the summaries we've included in our brief, because they are rife with detail about this lawsuit. This isn't one of those cases where there's some smoking gun of intent that doesn't become available until long after other details are available. Here, the very same facts that these plaintiffs used to base their complaint on were available long, long before.
This was a very big story.
It was a very big story. It was a very big story, and within 1 month, it was already the case that Goldman's involvement was being reported. Just one of the articles, this is on 66 of our brief, the Wall Street Journal published an article saying that the U.S. Treasury bond trading investigation had drawn in one of Wall Street's giants. Mr. Davis has named only two of the clients who received information, neither of whom is among the top tier of Wall Street bond trading activities. That changes with the involvement now of Goldman, and that's within a month of the harm. We don't need to pin inquiry notice on that date. We can wait another 9 months in order to hold that this claim was time barred. As far as the volume issue, again, that's an issue that that is a level of detail that's simply not required to trigger the running of a statute of limitations. We have cited a number of the articles reported in that time, including the one I just read from, that talked about Goldman's size in the marketplace, its ability, at least reported ability, to make hefty profits based on this kind of trading. It's certainly the case that we have argued throughout this litigation that there was no market manipulation here, that Goldman didn't have the intent to manipulate this market. We believe that to be the case today, and if we went to the merits, we would continue to assert that. But the facts that the plaintiffs used to allege that there was sufficient intent to manipulate, whether they're sufficient or not, those facts that they actually used were the same facts that were available long before they actually filed. And turning just briefly to the argument about fraudulent concealment, which I think is one of the more remarkable arguments in the case, the fraudulent concealment concept is an equitable idea, and it's designed to prevent to intercede if a defendant has prevented a plaintiff from suing on time. But there's no explanation here about how denials of wrongdoing by Goldman in 2002 and 2003 prevented these plaintiffs from filing their lawsuit in 2009. 7 years passed between the time when they were put on notice of their claims and when they filed. Granted, for much of that period, the limitations period was tolled, but they knew very well when that tolling period ended and yet still did not act promptly. I'd like to touch just very, very briefly on the merits of class certification, though, again, we've argued, and I think on a couple of grounds that that issue needn't be reached. But I just want to point out one important thing, and that's particularly in reference to the recent 28J letter. And that's that this is not the typical case where all the class members traded in a single security and were all injured in the same way, just in differing amounts. And you can apply a computer model at the end of the litigation to figure out everyone's individual damage. These people bought all kinds of things. The district court recognized that in his order specifically. They covered their short positions with a whole array of options. That the short positions ultimately could have been covered with cash, but they also could have been covered with bonds of different maturity dates, of futures with different terms, options with different delivery dates and strike prices. Certainly the prices of each of those different items are related in some sense, and you could look at how they're related, but they don't mathematically predict one another. And what that means is that different variables go into the prices for the different instruments, and we would have to come up with different inflation ribbons, to use the securities case damages lingo. We'd have to come up with different inflation ribbons and litigate them separately for each of these many instruments. And think about a stock and bond case. In a stock and bond case, one set of conduct, usually more than one class. We don't put the stocks and the bonds in the same class. We have separate class reps, and we litigate separately the impact of the conduct on the price of stocks and bonds because they don't mathematically track one another. This case is that much more complex because we'd have to do that same program for many, many, many more different instruments. The plaintiffs here never proposed subclasses, didn't address how we could possibly litigate all these things in one case, and I submit it wouldn't have been possible. There's just too much variability within the class to litigate all at once.
Why would it not have been possible under the proposed one-day class that came in later in the litigation? The district court never really addressed that on the merits, but denied those later motions on procedural grounds.
Well, it may have been a one-day class, but it still wasn't a one-instrument class. There were a number of different grounds that Judge Derjagin relied on in denying class certification. The open-endedness of the class was certainly one of them, but it was only one of them. He also talked about the differences within the class, the many issues that would have to be resolved, including the fact that they covered their positions with a whole array of different instruments, and that was a critical piece of his ruling.
Right. I don't think there's any question that there was not an abuse of discretion in the denial of the class that was originally proposed, but we had some later efforts to narrow the class definition, and there were a lot of procedural irregularities on everybody's part in the handling of this. But the argument is that those procedural irregularities were wrongly decided against the plaintiffs, and they have a point in at least some of those instances. The motion to amend the complaint to contain the narrowed class definition, or the narrowed class, was made before an answer was filed. And the futility argument isn't really appropriate at that stage,
well,
or at least in this context. You can make it, but it usually is a loser.
Normally, if there's no answer, it's hard. You get to amend. Here, we're talking about a case that had proceeded past summary judgment. So although there was no answer, the parties agreed to forego an answer to go to summary judgment. That was part of what the parties in the court agreed to. So in terms of the prejudice question, the absence of an answer doesn't really determine the question.
Is the record really clear on that? It was ambiguous.
About why there was no answer?
Right.
I think the record's not terribly clear about why there was no answer, but the one thing I can tell you it is clear about is that there was no answer, and yet the case proceeded to summary judgment. So there's no question that at the time of that answer, the proposed amended complaint, there had been motions for summary judgment. There had been a motion for class certification. There had been expert discovery. In fact, discovery was closing. So for all the reasons that you would normally say the absence of an answer prevents prejudice,
Here, whether there was an answer or not, there was still prejudice because the case had moved along that far. And it's not the absence of an answer that makes the prejudice. It's how far along the case has moved that makes the prejudice. And another point about that, though, there were a couple of reasons why the judge refused that motion to amend, and it was in January 2009. And one of them was that it was futile. Again, that motion for leave to amend and the later 23C1C motion fixed only one problem with the class. The only problem they fixed was the open-endedness. That was the only problem they fixed. When they made it a one-day class, they solved the problem of open-endedness. They did not solve the problem that the members of the class covered buying a whole array of different securities or different instruments at different times with different goals, and that whole array of problems was not addressed in any way by the proposed amendment or by the 23C motion. So, as I said, making it a single-day class still didn't make it a single-instrument class, and that's still a very critical problem. The plaintiff's talked here about standard methodologies for examining the relationships between prices of bonds and futures and options and different strike prices and so forth. But the plaintiff hasn't presented any reason why this Judge Derjagin could expect he would be able to try Premium Plus's claims and in so doing resolve the claims of others. And that's the idea behind the predominance requirement and the typicality requirements. We want the litigation over the named plaintiff to be able to resolve at least most of the elements of the liability vis-a-vis the other plaintiffs. And here that simply would not have happened because they covered using so many different instruments. And the fix that was proposed was not a complete fix. It was a partial fix, which is why Judge Derjagin recognized it as futile. Your Honors, affirming the orders here won't break any new ground. We're not talking about new principles of law. We're not talking about broad precedents and the unique facts of this case. In fact, don't call and shouldn't call for any new broad precedents. Under this Court's cases, the choices made by these particular plaintiffs and their lawyers have left them with nothing more to pursue. The orders should be affirmed. And
I'm curious about the interest. I know it's a small thing relative to everything else, but isn't compound interest the expected form of interest that would be awarded?
Yes, but it's not required.
And if not given, shouldn't some explanation be made for why compound interest was not given?
I think that's normally true. Here, we made an argument in our papers, and that argument was referenced by Judge Derjagin in his order. He referenced the argument we had made, and that was that awarding compound interest under these circumstances would make for too big an award under the circumstances of this case. And so he denied that request. He awarded simple, not compound, and he referred to the argument we made. And I would submit that's enough of an explanation.
But no separate reasoning on his own, would you agree?
No separate reasoning, but he referred to our reasoning. And again, this is in the context of discretion, and he had already talked about the delay in the case and the conduct of the parties. That was really the big issue on the interest issue. We were asking for an award of no interest. Premium Plus was asking for an award of a lot of interest, and the award that Judge Derjagin gave was in the middle, and we submit that that's clearly not an abuse of discretion. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Feta?
On the statute of limitations issue, there's no question that there were several reports on what had happened on October 31, 2001, but none of them provided the information that the plaintiffs needed to state a reasonable commodities manipulation claim, a manipulation claim that had a reasonable evidentiary basis. Goldman has not pointed to any facts in those articles that demonstrate it was known to the public that it acquired a sufficiently large long position to have caused artificial inflation of prices. The only facts it points to are vague references that it received the information from Davis and may have traded on that information. But that's different than causing artificial inflation of December 2001 contract prices. On the issue of Mr. Tomlinson's right to intervene, Rule 24 requires an interest, not a claim. And he has an interest in this litigation, and it's a twofold interest, to obtain an intervening decision, and because these claims cannot be prosecuted individually in any way that makes economic sense, to do so in a class-wide proceeding so he can shift and share the costs and fees with the class. That gets to the point of premium standing, and we just respectfully submit that Roper guides the outcome of this case. And in Roper, the Supreme Court recognized that a class representative's interest in shifting and sharing costs and fees with the class is an interest sufficient to give rise to Article III standing.
Although the context of Roper was very different than this case. That was an involuntary entry of judgment.
It was, Your Honor. But neither Roper nor Murrow nor Reitzel nor any of the Court of Appeals cases from the Eighth Circuit cited by Goldman turns on the issue of whether the Rule 68 offer or the settlement was involuntary or involuntary. They all turn on the issue of whether the plaintiff was reimbursed costs and fees by the defendant. Goldman did not reimburse costs and fees. It knowingly paid actual damages only. Premium informed Goldman that it only paid actual damages, and yet it went ahead with filing the Rule 68 offer. As for the computer model and whether a computer model can resolve the issue of artificiality attributable to Goldman, we did present such a model. Before class certification, Dr. Donaldson opined that he could do this. Judge Driagian did not reference his expert opinion in his initial class cert denial. And then after we were able to obtain the discovery, Dr. Donaldson ran the computer models. And the most clear computer models where damages across all instruments are calculated based on the same econometric analysis appear in our separate appendix at 254 to 259. And those are in the record. And they demonstrate that this commodities manipulation case can proceed efficiently on a class-wide basis. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.